Well, hello, TERFs and trannies. Welcome to Heterodorks, where I am your host, Corinna Cohn.
And I am your co-host, Nina Paley. And we have a special guest that we have been wanting to talk to for so long. And we are so happy to have her here. We have Alice Drager, author of Galileo's Middle Finger.
Welcome.
I'm delighted to be with you both. I have a feeling I'm going to get in terrible trouble for this, so let's do it.
Well, I wanted to ask you, first of all, are you on Team TERF or Team Tranny?
I don't think I'm actually on Team either. I think I don't know what team I'm on. I actually fail at teams. Let's say that. I am a lone runner. The sports I do are all individual sports, and I compete against myself because then I have no chance of winning, but I also win at the same time.
What about forced teams?
Oh, people are still forced to teams? I thought that was middle school. Are they still forced?
There's this phrase, forced teaming. So you could be forced to be on a team.
I don't spend enough time on normal social media. I spend all of my time looking at recipes, so you're going to have to explain all these things to me as we go.
Should I explain force teaming? Actually,
I think there's a brilliant example of it when it's usually used in this context. So, you know, in the very, very old days, it was gays and lesbians, and then GLBT, and then GLB, and then GLBT, and then LGBT. And then now, you know, it's LGBTQIA+. And a lot of reasonable people might ask, what the hell does intersex have to do with sexual orientation?
Right.
Well, that would be forced teaming.
Yeah. Or what does it have to do with LGBT even?
Right.
They force themselves onto the team, or somebody forced a team.
Well, no, I can actually tell you the history of that because I was around for that history. So, you know, I go way back in the intersex rights movement. I was one of the leaders of the Intersex Society of North America starting in the late 90s and forward. And this was one of the conversations we had, was whether or not to get the I attached to LGBT. I mean, we were not in charge of that decision. But there were good reasons to do it and good reasons not to do it. And one good reason to do it is because, frankly, a lot of intersex people were L or G or B or T, or some combination of those. And that's how they had come to recognize, to get to their political consciousness about intersex, was through those political consciousnesses. So it made sense in some ways to recognize that there was a singular experience there about being oppressed because of your life on that whole sex gender planet, which made straight society, as well as especially the whole medical profession, so incredibly tense. So it made some sense to think about that as a natural alliance. And then there were reasons not to do it, which was because when we did talk about lumping that in, then the doctors were like, oh, we don't have to talk to you because you're a bunch of activists for adults and we're talking about children, and children don't have identities. So, you know, like these kinds of identities. So go ahead and do that, do your rainbow stuff, but we're not going to talk to you. So there was a lot of conversation actually about whether or not it made sense to bring I into that mix. And there's still a lot of discussion about it, as you probably both know, about whether or not it makes any sense in terms of bringing it in. I mean, it's difficult because intersex is a political identity, but it's also sometimes used to talk about a constellation of medical conditions, or not even medical, inborn conditions. So it's really hard to know what you're even talking about when you're talking about that stuff. I mean, it's not that different in some ways from talking about, like, how do we think about being gay, right? Because a person could be gay, but not out to themselves. And do we think about them as being gay? It's a question. I think that's an open question. They might be androphilic or gynophilic in a way that is oriented to the same gender as themselves or the same sex as themselves. But if they're not out, are they gay? It's an interesting question.
What do you mean by a political? What do you mean when you say intersex is a political identity?
For folks who are working in intersex rights, they recognize that what they're trying to achieve is basically a cultural political change, a change in the attitude towards people who have body types that don't fit the standard male or the standard female type in terms of the way that they were born. And so they are recognizing that what they're aiming for is something that is fundamentally a cultural change in attitude. So in that sense, it's a political identity.
Could I identify as intersex?
It depends on what definition you're using. So this, again, is a big point of discussion for people who deal with these questions, right? So intersex was defined 1,000 years ago. I was around for this. I think Beau Laurent, who went by the activist name Cheryl Chase, was the person who came up with a definition which said that intersex was by definition people who doctors had decided didn't fit the standard male or the standard female category. So if you go with that definition, then you have to look at what the medical system accepts as not needing their attention, shall we put it that way? And then the people who don't need their attention, according to them, would not count as intersex, and everybody else would count as intersex. But we could define intersex in a different way, which is to say, if you have anything about your body that makes you not fit the cultural definitions of male or female, you might be thinking of yourself as intersex. So in that case, it could be somebody, for example, who has a severe case of polycystic ovary disease, where their ovaries are making a lot of hormones and changing the way their sex body works. And this was one of the questions I used to get from folks who did have polycystic ovary diseases. Does this count as intersex? And I would say, you know, it totally depends on how we define intersex in terms of how things happen. And then we could also, I think, legitimately ask the question, okay, are we only talking about conditions that spring up, you know, without intervention? What if something happened to you developmentally because you were exposed to a chemical along the way? Could that count? What if you were somebody who was dysphoric or trans and you decided to change some parts of your body? Could that count? And what I tell people is this is a human definition, right? Nature doesn't say this is what counts. We decide what counts. So intersex changes its definition depending on the context. That's not to say that the conditions that, you know, I worked on for years in terms of trying to advocate for people within those populations were not real biological conditions. They are. But the way the medical system treats them is as problems. And it's that point at which they become a problem where they become sort of solidified as a political issue, as far as I'm concerned, because that's where we have to do patient advocacy work.
So you're saying that intersex can be defined a number of different ways. Do you have your own definition of intersex?
Nope. I gave it up a long time ago.
Really?
Because I am a historian and I happen to know that categories change and that I am a weak person in the face of history. And I'm not going to try to define for people what counts and what doesn't count. So, you know, I don't like people misrepresenting their history. I don't like it when somebody claims to have, for example, androgen insensitivity syndrome, and they don't. That bothers me, but it does not trouble me when people decide to use a different definition, because I don't think I'm in charge of that. I know I'm not in charge of that.
So do you have a, I'm sorry, I know Corinna really wants to ask questions, but I have one more question before I let Corinna butt in, which is, do you have a definition of woman, or is that also...
No, I gave that up too. No, I don't. I know that has changed over time historically. And right now it's a very contentious word and people are fighting over what it means. My own personal feeling is that we should be a lot more calm about these terms and try to be together peaceably and not fight all the time. So one of the things that I say a lot is, you know, riffing on Dr. Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech, that we should judge people not by the content of their, the color of their skin, nor should we judge them by the shape of their skin, nor, as far as I'm concerned, should we judge them by the history of their skin. We should judge them by the way they treat other people. And so, you know, I mean, if you want to talk about bathrooms, I'm 55 years old. I spent plenty of time in women's bathrooms being harassed by natal women who either wanted to engage me in some special womanly thing or wanted to hit on me. The fact that people who were natal women did that didn't make it any more pleasant than if somebody was a transgender woman and did that to me. As far as I'm concerned, like, don't use my need to go pee or poo as an opportunity to have a sexual encounter with me, unless for some reason I've signaled to you that's why I'm there, and I've not done that. So, you know, for me, I don't care who's in the bathroom with me. I don't care who's around me. I just want them to treat me well, have self-respect, treat other people well. And I try to do the same thing in my life. you know, I am, as far as I know, biologically female, in the standard way, in the way that doesn't trouble medicine, except that everything about femaleness troubles medicine. But other than that, but I don't feel like I've ever had a moment in my life where I'm like, I am woman, you know, like this is what it means to be a woman. I feel very much like I'm this leaf being tossed around in the river of history. I don't know if that's how you both feel. That's how I feel. I feel like, you know, being swept along and banged into the shore every now and then.
Yeah, I don't feel, I mean, of course I do feel like a leaf being blown around, but I definitely define things. I definitely use definitions. For me, definitions are a excellent and necessary thinking tool for using reason, applying reason, and having a, you know, having arguments. The arguments don't work if there aren't definitions. So I appreciate definitions.
I get that. I've been spending a lot of time with the Tao Te Ching, and I'm trying to get out of arguments. So.
Yeah, well, if you don't like to argue, then you shouldn't be in an argument.
Not going to argue with that.
Yeah.
Corinne, exactly. I want to hear what you're thinking, Corinna, because I love the way your eyebrows keep going up. You're a big eyebrow person. I love your eyebrows because they keep going up in very interesting ways.
Yeah, I don't play poker.
Fair.
So you made a comment that there was never like a real moment where you felt like, aha, I'm woman. I feel like woman now. And I feel bad for you because I've definitely had those moments.
Oh, that's great. What does that feel like?
Well, it was a mistake. I shouldn't have felt that way in the first place because that was one of the things that really made it a lot more difficult for me to achieve any sort of mental equilibrium, because mm-hmm. what was happening is that I was using a lot of external validation to try to make my internal state better. So immediately after having, I'm going to call it gender affirmation surgery, because I know that's going to trigger some of our listeners. After I had gender affirmation surgery and my gender was affirmed by having it surgically altered, I was like, now I'm a woman. It's fantastic. When I had very disappointing sexual intercourse for the first time afterwards with my boyfriend, I was like, now I'm a woman.
Because you had disappointing sex.
Yes.
Yes, that is the definition of being a woman.
I mean, that I've had disappointing sex also, and I'm a woman, so you do have something in common with a lot of women.
That is something that we all have in common, yeah. Go ahead.
Well, truly, that is the most female of experiences, so, like, obviously, I'm in the right category, right? So all of these things I would continue to use, like, well, now I've made it, and then anytime that I had any sort of experience that put in my face, hey, you have male biology, you are actually not a woman, it would cause me a huge amount of distress. And I've never really had an experience where I feel like, now I'm a man. Although I have a couple little hairs that grow right underneath my lip, and when I pluck those out, maybe that's sort of like my Disney hero moment. But I don't have a lot of those sorts of masculine sensations, I guess, either. But I would think that at least when you gave birth, that would have been maybe at least once in your life that you were like, aha, now I'm a woman.
I was gonna say I get my mustache waxed off once a month, and I always think of Steel Magnolias every time my hairdresser waxes my mustache off once a month. So I always think, oh, that's like in my mind is this picture of all these women having a good time at the salon. And I don't know, I just have never felt that sort of high of being in the salon. But when I gave birth, what I felt like was like I was channeling the universe. I didn't birth with any drugs. And so I was using pain techniques that I had learned, which was basically to do visualization. And I was doing visualization through the pain. And the pain was like completely all consuming. It was very exciting. I know that sounds really strange, but it was a very exciting level of pain. I'm not normally into pain, my spouse could tell you, but it was really transformative. And I felt like I was just this vehicle of wonderful light and power in the universe. And it was such an incredible feeling. And then the kid was born, and I remember saying to my spouse, like, I don't want to be pregnant again, but I would totally give birth again. Like pregnancy, you know, I had sciatica and hemorrhoids and the kid was poking at my rib and everything. And I did not feel like Earth Mother or anything like that. And really the same thing with breastfeeding. I had postpartum depression, so that probably interrupted a lot of the joy of the early time. I think when I do feel kind of female, the times I've felt sort of perhaps most female in terms of really enjoying the body that I have, which is a female typical body, is when I'm in really having really good sexual intercourse, when I'm really, really having great sex. And I think for a lot of us, that's actually the moment we feel our genders most intensely, is in the sexual moments. Not true for everybody, because not everybody's oriented in terms of sex and gender. So, you know, some people are oriented to other kinds of issues. But most of us are sex and gender kind of oriented. And it's really during those times when I think I've felt most like, wow, you know, this is a body that feels very like it has a certain amount of feminine power. But I'm not sure I really experience it per se as feminine. I experience it as a fleshy, beautiful body thing. So keep in mind, you know, my background is history of anatomy. So I'm primarily a historian of anatomy. So where I'm coming out of is a master's and PhD background that is very much about watching the way that body concepts have changed over time. So for me, as an academic, where the attempt is always to disassociate the brain, you know, so many academics would prefer they just have no body. They would like to just be a brain in a bottle. They don't exercise. They get annoyed when their body is sick. They often are ashamed of even wanting a family, you know, or a dog even. Like academics are very much in that old monastic tradition of valuing the brain and not valuing the body. But I really, because I was coming out of this area of using my brain to think about bodies, I really decided a long time ago to start actively thinking about my body. And I do a lot of exercise. I do a lot of meditation. I have to take very careful care of what I eat because I have a lot of food intolerances. And so I have a feeling that I'm different from a lot of people, because what I'm experiencing is sort of all of those potentials of my flesh that are really not that much about sex. They're just about having a body. Because of course, males have nipples that work. And, you know, the clitoris is the penis. And there's so much that's the same developmentally with us that I'm not thinking about, you know, I have this special female thing. I'm thinking, wow, my nipples feel really good. But males' nipples feel really good too, if they're played with correctly. So I don't have this heavy duty bifurcation of male and female in my mind. And I wish a lot of us could just feel really good about our flesh without having to politicize it.
There are some people who feel bad about their flesh. And I have a feeling you know what group this is. This is young women, especially going through puberty. In your experience as a historian of bodies, could you relate to us at all how the experience of puberty may have changed over time?
Yeah. So, I mean, puberty has always been this, for females especially, right, has always been this incredibly politically charged thing. And that's true cross-culturally. If we look back, for example, at the witch trials of Europe, the great witch trials, and also the ones in colonial America, they frequently involved pubertal girls. And it is often the case that sort of witchiness is attributed to pubertal girls.
Wait. I thought that the pubertal girls in the witch trials were accusing the older women of being witches.
They were accusing, but then there was also this sort of flip-flopping all around, right, about who was what. So they were getting possessed but in some cases they were also being identified as sort of essentially inhabited by the devil, you know, having intercourse with the devil. If you look at what the witch trials are talking about, they're talking about sex with the devil. So female puberty is this very politically charged thing cross-culturally, which makes total sense because it's the moment, right, where a female is transitioning from being a child, which is just a child in the world, to being something that is now capable of either procreating and continuing the group or not. Males, no matter how much power males have, they can't deny the power that the female body has that they lack, which is the ability to actually make another one, right, to make another person. So female puberty is very charged. The other thing is that, you know, females around the world, not in every single culture, but in many cultures, are sort of not told the truth about their bodies and the truth about what's about to happen. So puberty can be a very, very disconcerting thing. The things that the female body undergoes, the typical female body undergoes at puberty, is not the same as what the typical male body undergoes. There's two critical things that occur with menstruation. One is blood comes out of you, right? Which is usually a bad sign for anything else in the world, right? When there's blood coming out, usually it's a bad thing. The second thing that occurs is pain, which is also normally a sign of something being a problem. So I don't think it's too surprising that, you know, a lot of people, girls especially, who have not had a positive introduction to their bodies are going to experience a situation where they're facing blood and pain as something that is stressful, because it's naturally stressful to have blood and pain. Our brains are wired to say blood bad, pain bad, right? And that's one of the things I had to work on when I was getting ready to birth without pain medications. My doula, who's a labor support coach, kept saying to me, it's critically important that you remember that pain normally triggers a physiological response of fright and stress, because something bad is happening. You have to override that. You have to override it by telling yourself, this pain is good. This pain is normal. This pain is manageable. This pain is not dangerous. And she said, I will remind you of that if I need to. But she didn't need to, because we'd worked together for months. So when I would have a contraction and I would start to get frightened, because your body naturally frightens at pain, I would say to myself, oh no, this is good pain. This is labor pain. This is positive pain. This is growth pain. And then I would really calm down and it would calm me down. So I think that, you know, puberty can be a very stressful thing if it's not managed well. I remember, I don't know if this held up over time, but I remember there was a study a million years ago that showed that Catholic girls experienced much more pain with menstruation than non-Catholic girls. And I was raised Catholic, and that made total sense to me, because of course, when you're raised Catholic, nobody tells you anything about what's about to happen. And there's this very sex negative attitude. And so of course, having pain is very scary, right? So it's not too surprising to me that Catholic girls would report more pain on average, because I think what they're experiencing is pain plus stress, which makes more pain. If you have pain and you add fright to it, the pain gets worse. That's so
interesting. I had very liberal secular parents, and my mom worked for Planned Parenthood all throughout childhood.
My mom picketed Planned Parenthood.
There you go. And my mom brought home these enlightened 1970s books for children, like What's Happening to Me about puberty. Have you ever seen that book, What's Happening to Me?
I have. They were totally forbidden from my life. Yes.
Oh, the illustrations were so good. It was a really good book. And, you know, all these other books about how babies are made and stuff, like, you know, with great illustrations for kids. So I was aware of all of this stuff. It did not help one iota. So, you know, but it was like, it was my mom's attempt to rectify, you know, what she thought was missing from her own upbringing. And no, it did not help at all.
And so what did you go through?
Well, puberty and excruciating pain and like physical pain and, you know, major depression and gender dysphoria. Mm-hmm. There was no word for it then. And yeah, it was just awful. There was really no degree of preparation. You know, there was nothing that anybody could have said. Which is kind of, I mean, that's kind of a cool thing about it, which is that it's an experience that has to be lived it's a real thing that you go through, and it can't really be mediated. So that's, you know, terrifying about it, but it's also in some ways an amazing thing about it, because so much of our experience is mediated and controlled, and there are some things you just can't control.
Yeah. That's why I wish more women got to birth the way that I did, because I think it is such a transforming experience in terms of recognizing the letting go into something in which you're part of something bigger. And that for me was the most transformative part, was just the sense of being part of something larger than myself and really feeling like connected to the universe in a way that I rarely felt before that.
Maybe one of the things that's happening over time is that we depend much more on secular institutions like schools to relate some of the information that we were just talking about, like what happens with your body in puberty. So we have sex education classes. And these institutions have become these very powerful communicators and normalizers of all sorts of different cultural norms. And one of the things I'm sort of wondering about these kids who are going through puberty is whether, if we were to put more energy into communicating more that what's happening to your body is normal, and that the pain, this is a good pain because this is your it shows that your body's working correctly. This is mm-hmm. what you should anticipate. You shouldn't be frightened by it. You should expect it. I wonder if we pressed more on messages like that, if that would help kids, because I think the alternative that's sort of happening right now is that if you feel uncomfortable in your body, if you're having some distress because of what you're going through, that's not normal. Instead, maybe you should think about changing your gender or going on to puberty blockers. In other words, I wonder if this fairly recent interest in going on puberty blockers and cross-sex hormones is partly because kids are trying to escape these fairly normal or completely normal changes in puberty. Do you have a feeling on that?
Yeah, I mean, that could be. The other thing that bothers me is that we don't really address sexual pleasure in when we're teaching kids about sex, and the consequence, because we're scared of talking with kids about sexual pleasure, which I get, right? There's a line we don't want to cross. We don't want to engage them in a conversation that is inappropriate. But at the same time, the fact that we rarely talk with them about sexual pleasure means that I think they don't have a sense of what might feel good. We don't encourage them, for example, to go ahead and explore their own bodies the way in the 70s, you know, the women's health movement did in terms of our bodies ourselves and the Boston Women's Health Collective. If there was a way to talk with children that are growing more about figure out what feels good about your body, then maybe they would focus less on what feels wrong and start to really understand what feels good. And part of that would be masturbation, right? Part of that would be exploring their own bodies and figuring out physically what feels good about their genitals and other parts of their bodies. And I think so much of the time, we just don't talk about masturbation at all. You know, we simply leave it off the sex ed curriculum entirely, which to my mind is very problematic, because you really do need to get to know how things feel. And, you know, one of the things I always say to young people who are talking with me about their sex lives when they're in their late teens or their early 20s and they're just starting to have sex with other people in those circumstances, you know, is the first few hundred times, it's probably not going to feel quite right, because it takes a while before you figure out what feels good and what doesn't feel good.
I beg your pardon. Did you say the first few hundred times?
Yeah, that's my feeling.
Wow.
And I would include in that, you know, both masturbation and having sex with other people, that it takes, well, I'm 55 now, and it took until maybe my late 30s or 40s before I really nailed it in terms of really understanding what feels good about myself when I'm being sexual. So, and when I talk with other people, well, not males, because I don't really understand them a lot of the times in terms of the way that their sexual function feels. But if I'm talking to people who were born sort of standard females, a lot of times they say the same thing to me. It's like, yeah, it took a really long time before I really understood this feels good. That doesn't feel good. You know, this gets me off. That doesn't get me off. This thing feels interesting when it's stroked this way, but not when it's touched this way. Like the clitoris is this crazy, complicated organ that frankly is very picky and very difficult to deal with. And if you talk with women, they will.
The most feminine of organs.
Yeah. But it's a very, you know, it in terms of its anatomy, it's packed with nerves. It takes the nerves of the penis and collapses them into a tiny little spot. And it can take a long time before you sort of figure out what feels good in terms of touching or not touching and different types of touching. So I wish that I wish there was a way for us to talk with kids more about just saying, go off and like, exploration is fine with your own body and figure out what feels good and what doesn't feel good.
I was that kid. I had all that great stuff.
So why do you think you felt dysphoric, or what would now be called dysphoric?
Because it's just not the answer to everything. Everybody tries to think of, again, my mom was, and her cohorts were trying to, they thought about what they identified problems in their own upbringing and things that stressed them out in their own upbringing. And they said, I am going to make sure my daughter doesn't suffer this. I'm going to make sure my daughter knows what's going on, is encouraged, you know, to explore her body, is not shamed for masturbation, is everything you were just saying. I mean, that's why I was smiling through it. I was like, yes, they did that. And because there's a whole bunch of other issues that come up that you can't.
Well, that's why I think it takes a few hundred times.
No, I don't mean a few hundred times. I mean, there's other neuroses that come from that kind of upbringing.
I see.
That there is.
Certainly.
There's actually, I feel bad about how repressed my mom was and how repressed generations of people were. But I will say that the experiments that were going on in my own generation created other kinds of neuroses.
I could certainly believe that.
And, you know, to the point where now that it's done and I'm in menopause, that I'm like a lot, I actually understand more why people don't talk about sex. That in fact, when you talk about it a lot and when you educate it a lot, you are in fact mediating it or attempting to mediate it. And there is a real loss that comes from that. You know, if you have these adults telling you about pleasure, you know, and like, oh, you know, it feels good. This feels good. It's, you know, and it's like, then you're actually doing it. And it's not your own experience. Mm-hmm. It's a mediated experience, and all the advice and stuff that has come to you from other people interferes with it. And if people hadn't talked about sex all that time, you could actually have an unmediated or a less mediated experience.
I'm not sure it's ever possible to get away from the mediation of sex, because so much of culture is set up to regulate sex, right? So much of
there's more and there's less. And yes. Like one thing I noticed about Catholics when I was in sex positive San Francisco in the 90s, working for the San Francisco Sex Information Hotline, was that the Catholics were a lot kinkier than other people, and they were getting like a lot. They were getting so much out of, they were so easily getting so much out of stuff, you know, possibly because of their, because they hadn't had the freedom.
Because they were so hungry,
they were hungry, you know, and it's sort of like, you know, you can spoil people too.
Yeah. I don't mean to be suggesting that parents should interfere with their kids' sex lives by, you know, handing them masturbatory devices and, you know.
No, that's not what I mean. That's not what my parents did either. It's just, you know, like a good quality liberal sex education you know, you think it's going to be hang up free, but it's not. It's just not. They're just going to be different hangups.
You know, I just remember, so I've written about this. I think it was in Pacific Standard or something. When my son was like 6 years old, maybe seven, and the movie Juno came out, and you know, that movie's about a girl who gets accidentally pregnant. And there was this conversation going around in first grade or second grade, whatever he was in, about the movie Juno, because it was all very exciting and interesting to think about a teenager getting pregnant. And so my son came home to me and he kind of was rolling his eyes and he said, like, you know, you can't get accidentally pregnant. And I said to him what he meant. He's like, well, it's not like, you know, you burn yourself on the stove accidentally. You know you're having sex. So how could you get accidentally pregnant? And I realized that I had left out sort of this key part of information, which is that sex is exciting enough that sometimes you don't take precautions, right? Because he knew about the basics of birth control and that kind of thing. And so I had to explain to him, well, exactly that, right? Well, sometimes sex is exciting enough that you do stupid things and you accidentally get pregnant, or you accidentally get a disease, or somebody accidentally gets hurt in the process, right? And so I had to explain to him that, you know, nature set it up so that sex feels good, because otherwise animals wouldn't do it. And so built into sex is this whole, it feels really good thing. And he asked me, what does that feel like? And I said, well, you know, when you have an itch on your back and somebody scratches it for you and it feels amazing. And he said, yes. And I said, well, when you're older, your genitals will have the ability to sort of have that experience, and you'll have that itch scratched and it's going to feel really good. And that's what it feels like. And it causes you to want it, and you want it, and you might do stupid things, just like, you know, M&Ms taste really good and you may eat too many M&Ms, even though you know you should stop eating M&Ms. It's the same sort of thing. So that had been kind of left out. And then when he got, you know, older in school and was going through school, I could tell the curriculum wasn't dealing with pleasure at all. And so mostly I was concerned that the whole message being given in his public school education was sex is this dangerous thing. And the kids understandably probably felt like, well, you know, like, we're going to do it anyway because it feels good. And why is nobody talking about that? And I just felt like somebody should acknowledge that the reason we're drawn to sex is because it feels good if it's done right. But I do think it takes a long time for people to feel their bodies. It's, you know, well, I mean,
I just want to say one more thing about the feels good thing, because it keeps coming up in my memory, this book, How Babies Are Made. I don't know if you saw this 70s classic children's book with lovely paper illustrations. And it, you know, it showed, you know, animals having intercourse and then humans having intercourse, as, you know, the man and the woman, they rub against each other because it feels good. And afterwards they're tired. And I was just like, feels good. And when I saw that, I was like, yeah, right. I was like, why the hell would anybody do this?
I remember it feels good.
Sure it does.
I remember thinking the same thing. That didn't make any sense that would feel good. It seemed like not a very comfortable thing to think about.
Way more sex education than I did.
What did you have, Corinna, in terms of sex education?
Well, so I remember my dad wouldn't say anything. I don't think he wanted my sister and I to know that the human body could do anything that would produce a child, probably because he had some regret that he had his own. My mom, like, whispered to me at one point, everybody masturbates. This okay. is the last we're talking about it. Oh, okay. All right. I was a middle and high school student right as the AIDS crisis was peaking. And so a lot of our sex education was...
terrifying.
Yeah. Always use a condom. Never have gay sex. The gays are getting AIDS because they're dirty and immoral.
Right.
And I sort of internalized some of that, probably, because even though I was having crushes on some of my schoolmates, you know, that those were, that's wrong and dirty and don't do that. And the sex education was very mechanical, and what I got from my parents wasn't really anything about pleasure. It was just wait until you're older. That was about the most useful advice that was handed down.
That's good advice. That's good. No, that's what I would say to any sexually active young woman. I would say wait until you're older.
How much older?
Until you're menopausal, until you're past menopause.
Oh, okay.
I don't get
sex.
No. No, to have a much health a to be free of desire. It's awesome.
I see.
Just wait. It's like, wow, if I had always looked forward to menopause my entire fertile life, and I am not disappointed.
It is a revelation. It is certainly a revelation to have a very, very different level of drive. It's really interesting.
I love it.
You know, something just occurred to me, Nina, and Alice, I don't know if you've seen this drawing that Nina produced called the eunuch corn.
No. The gender eunuch
corn. The gender eunuch corn. But you've had a hysterectomy, Nina. And so aren't you like more likely to develop brittle bones? And you've kind of got some wounds and scars, and you're opting not to take HRT, but if you did, you might become a prolonged medical patient.
Yes, I'm 53. This is age appropriate. Menopause is appropriate for 53-year-olds. It's not appropriate for 15-year-olds.
But you had your ovaries out or just your uterus?
No, just my uterus. My ovaries are shutting down on their own.
Okay, all right.
So that's important because the ovaries keep helping.
I'm real glad I got my. I was not thrust into.
Yeah, you don't need HRT menopause. If your ovaries are still there. Yeah.
Yeah. No, it's like I'm old. It's like old people get to be old, and young people have to be young. They don't get to be old. It's not right for young people to have medical menopause and you know, osteoporosis and all that sort of stuff. It's almost inevitable when you're older to have those things happen, but it's not for the youngsters. They get to have healthy bodies, healthy young bodies until they geezer out.
Yeah, I never experienced a healthy body. I was severely lactose intolerant and undiagnosed. So I was extremely miserable until I was about 23 and finally self-diagnosed and stopped having pain and diarrhea all the time. It was quite a revelation, actually, because I didn't know I was in pain all the time until I wasn't in pain all the time. And then I was very energetic because I was like, why are other people not more energetic? Because they're not in pain all the time. And like, I've discovered what that's like. So
I discovered what that was like after my hysterectomy.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm much better now.
Well, how come your parents didn't notice that you were lactose intolerant?
They knew that I had weight problems where I couldn't gain weight, and I had this persistent bad leg pain, which in retrospect was my colon swelling on my sciatic nerve. But the doctor said that I was nervous. I had a nervous stomach.
What?
And that's, yeah. So he also pointed out that, like, I must not like this particular class, which occurred on Fridays because I always had diarrhea on Fridays. Well, that's because my mother always made lasagna on Thursday nights. My mother had a schedule where she made the same thing every week.
Oh, my gosh.
Thursday night was lasagna. So I had diarrhea every Friday because it was lasagna, not because of. Yeah. So this was the family doctor. And when I, I was like, I think I was 22 years old and I was like withering away and I was sure I had stomach cancer or something. Right. So I heard about this thing called an elimination diet where you could remove everything and then try to figure out maybe there was a food trigger. This was a relatively new concept. This was in the 80s. And so I did this and by like day three, I discovered I was severely lactose intolerant. I went back to the doctor and I was like, oh, by the way, he had told me I was getting an ulcer and I should drink more milk. So for 2 years, I was drinking large quantities of milk, which is why I was withering away to nothing. My fingernails were coming off. You know, my hair was falling out. I was completely malnourished. And I also had ceased puberty because I was so malnourished. So I had stopped my puberty by accident. And I went back to him and I was like, I'm lactose intolerant, you idiot. And he said, oh, you can't be because you're white. All the women in your family have nervous stomachs. You just have a nervous stomach. I was just like, go fuck yourself. So I took myself off milk and figured out that I had a problem, but then later developed a gluten intolerance. And now I have a tapioca intolerance. And, you know, my body just, there's a lot of shit it doesn't like. And I think it's because I was really wounded physically by eating things I shouldn't have been eating for so many years.
My mom was lactose intolerant, and there's a family story when she was young that she wouldn't drink her milk, and they took her to the doctor, and the doctor said, well, give her pudding instead, and she wouldn't eat her pudding. And the doctor said, well, give her ice cream instead, and she wouldn't eat the ice cream. And her parents said, you don't get to eat. I mean, she wanted to eat salad instead, or you know, her dinner. Said, no, no salad until you've finished your ice cream.
Yeah, it's why I don't force any child to eat anything, because I always think maybe they do have a natural sense of what they should and shouldn't be eating.
My mom was the same way, and I really appreciate that.
That child might just have a nervous stomach.
They might. They might. Yeah. Nervous stomach.
They're trying to get out of their Friday class. So did you have some this is personal, but tell me to, you know, move on. But did you have any resentment to your parents?
Oh, yeah. About everything, of course. Yeah. Isn't that normal?
Oh, yeah, I guess. But I mean, well, I guess you've got a couple of topics, but
yeah, it took my mother. Yeah, it took my mother a really long time to acknowledge that I was lactose intolerant. She would joke, Alice is not allergic, she's just very intolerant. She would make these jokes, right? And she was like not convinced that I was really sick until finally she actually saw the results of my accidentally getting exposed to milk one day. So I progressed, which a lot of people do who were severely lactose intolerant and kept eating milk. I became allergic to dairy products, specifically the protein in milk. And so now I get migraines if I get exposed to dairy proteins. And my mother witnessed my accident. Somebody gave me something and had milk in it. My mother witnessed me vomiting and holding a pillow over my eyes. And like then she believed that I actually had an issue with milk. So yeah, no, I definitely resented it. But what can you do? I mean, you know, it's not like my mother didn't believe me that I had diarrhea and pain. It's just she didn't believe that milk could cause these things. At the time, you know, it was not common for people to say they were lactose intolerant. It was a very uncommon thing to talk about. So I get it. But I would have liked to have been diagnosed many, many years sooner. It would have been nice. So what ended up happening was that I hit a new round of puberty in my 20s because my body finally had enough calories to finish puberty. So I grew taller in graduate school, which was bizarre. I grew breasts, I grew hips. I had not grown these things because I looked like a, you know, pubescent girl in terms of my physical body manifestations. And that was a problem because the guys who were attracted to me in retrospect were hebephiles, guys who were attracted to pubescent girls. So even though I was 18 and 19 and 20, the guys who were into me were guys who were hebephiles because they were into the flat chested, no ass, no hips kind of girl. And that's the way my body was. And it was only after I actually went through full puberty and grew a more standard adult female body that men who were not hebephiles started to become more interested in me. So that was kind of fascinating to me retrospectively. I didn't know it at the time because I didn't know the term, but I had been sexually used by a teacher in high school who was into pubertal girls. And it was easy for him to, you know, be attracted to me because I had the body type of a 12-year-old for a long time because I was malnourished. So yeah, not fun.
That was when you're in high school?
Yes. We didn't have all these terms back then, but he groomed me for a few years and then had sex with me. Yeah, he was a jerk.
Did he ever get his comeuppance?
Just after I got married, when I would have been 29 years old, I got a call from a lawyer for the school district. And they told me that he had done it to another girl and that they knew it had happened to me. And I never knew that they knew it had happened to me because they never did anything about it. And they asked me if I would testify. It was past the statute of limitations for me. But would I testify in that case? And I said no. And the reason I said no is I didn't want to live through it again.
Yeah.
So I think that's part of the reason why I spent so much of my life after that dealing on justice issues. Because I think I really felt bad for not being willing to go to court and testify on that. But I just didn't want to go through it again. I just didn't really want to go through it all again. I'd gone through therapy. I dealt with it, you know, I'm crying now telling you this, but having to deal with it brought it all up again. And I just didn't want to deal with it. So, but yeah, he's an asshole. I don't know what happened to him. I decided not to, I don't look it up. Yep. I just, it was what's was weird to me is that, of course, apparently people knew, and I had no idea that they knew, and they didn't help me. So that was disappointing.
Well, I hope there's some karma for people who were bystanders. But
I don't know. I mean, at the very least, it's certainly something that has helped me understand the whole, you know, the women who have been through similar things.
A few years ago, you started a newspaper, which most people who are entrepreneurs don't just decide to start a newspaper. It's a really tough business to get into. Can you tell us a little bit about your publication and how it started?
Sure. It's called East Lansing Info, and it's at eastlansinginfo.news. It was not started to make money, so it was not an entrepreneurial endeavor. It was started because I was witnessing the death of news nationwide. And I experienced that because I had been doing intersex rights work and we needed the media to help us. And little by little, the health journalists were disappearing and science journalists were disappearing. And then investigative journalists were disappearing because the internet had radically altered the news economy, just like Spotify and all the rest had changed the music economy. And there was a developer down the hill from my house who was supposed to be redeveloping some properties, and he had a very problematic track record. So one of my neighbors came by and told me about this, and we became involved as a neighborhood, and we started going to city council, which I'd never done before in East Lansing. And I started realizing that all this crap was happening at city council that was going to impact our lives, and nobody was paying any attention because we're all a bunch of progressives in a progressive town. We just assume we elect progressives, everything's progressive, don't pay any attention. And the stuff I was watching them do, I was like, what the hell? They were passing crazy laws and doing these development deals that were benefiting basically corporations. And I was like, if anybody was paying attention, this would not be happening. So I started a news cooperative, which was also called East Lansing Info. And it was a purely non-economic news cooperative. It was basically, I called it a news brigade. It was people who were willing to do factual reporting could contribute stuff to the site, but it had to be factual reporting. It had to just be sort of straightforward. They couldn't mean, didn't mean it couldn't be sharp. It could be sharp, but it had to be factual. And we did that for a while and it was good, but the problem was that because it was non-economic, there was nobody sort of paying active attention to it. So in 2000 and, well, so this developer kept going and being problematic. And in 2013, on the winter solstice of 2013, we had a huge ice storm. And the ice storm destroyed all the lines, the electrical lines in town. And the power company, which is a local mom and pop power company owned by the city of Lansing, had not trimmed the trees in 100 years, literally. So we lost the whole grid. And it was freaking cold. It was below freezing. The ice was everywhere. You couldn't get anywhere. We were without power. And it became clear after a few days that they had 4 crews total for the entire region. And they were not calling in more crews. And we were, our pipes were freezing. Our pets were freezing. We were freezing. It was horrible. It was absolutely horrible. So we staged a protest trying to get some media attention. My spouse decided to call it Cold Pussy Riot, which I thought was a great name for a protest. And we had a bunch of protest signs and we protested and there was a little bit of news media attention. It helped a little bit. But I realized, you know what? I got to like do a real newspaper because we're never going to have protection if we don't have news. So I convened a board in 2000.
Could I interrupt you for a second? You just said you wouldn't have protection if you didn't have news. That's a really interesting construction there.
Yeah, we had nobody who was willing or able to go out and find out what was going on with the power company. And when were they going to call more crews? And were we going to get crews to come? And so I was part of a small renegade group, which mostly used Twitter and email to try to get people reconnected. We were literally doing house by house by house. There was one guy who was about to be homeless. He was not a guy on the bottom of the income spectrum, but he had spent all of his money staying at a hotel. He had no more money left in the house. The problem was he needed the mast attached to the house to be reconstructed. And the mast is a private thing. And he couldn't reach his elderly landlord in Florida. The guy had gone just accidentally off the grid and he couldn't reach this guy. And you could not get power reattached if you didn't have the mast repaired. So basically I just called my electrician. I was like, Randy, just I'm going to pay you off the books. Pretend this guy has given you permission. Just go hook up this guy's mast so he can get back in his house and not be homeless. And so Randy did it. Guy's name was Anthony, who was at that house. And he called me like a year ago. He's like, do you remember me? You helped me out. And I was like, yeah. He goes, I just bought my own house. I was so excited. Anyway, that's just a side story. But we were like, it was ridiculous. It was like the 19th century, honestly. We were trying to help each other. There was no news organization interested in what was going on. The Lansing State Journal was doing a little bit, but nothing meaningful. So in 2014, I convened a board. We created a 501c3 nonprofit organization called East Lansing Info, and we hired a managing editor, and we started taking donations to have a newspaper run every day. And now it's in its eighth fiscal year. I am the executive director and publisher and one of the reporters, but it's mostly run by my managing editor, Emily Joan Elliott, and we run on about $185,000 a year. We pay string reporters and we go to meetings. Like tonight at 7 o'clock, I have to go to city council. I just came from the board of review earlier. And we basically just help each other out by bringing factual news.
Is it in print or online?
Until this year, it was entirely online. We decided to do something radical this year and actually produce a few print editions because we realized there were people we've never reached in town. And so we took that and we basically took the voter rolls and we mailed a copy to everybody on the voter rolls. And we hooked up a whole bunch more people that way. And we also got a lot more donors that way. So that's been great. So the paper edition comes out about once every 2 months. And it's really directed at sort of let us catch you up and get you signed up to what we do. But we provide news for free to anybody who needs it. And we get questions answered. So ironically, this past weekend, something happened here, which was like that storm. So there was this huge wind thing that came through, as you guys may have heard. So it blew through Michigan. And a bunch of wires blew down on the train tracks, on the Canadian National train tracks that run through town. And a train came and hit the wires. And when the train hit the wires, the train pulled down the entire grid in that area. So it snapped the poles in half and brought down the electrical grid. Well, as part of that, it also brought down the Comcast grid. And Comcast may seem trivial to people, but it's actually the way people are working from home. It's the way they get information, right? So after 3 days, which was yesterday, people were calling me being like, yeah, well, I mean, a lot of people working and doing school from home, but also a lot of senior citizens, and that's their telephone, their internet, and their television were all taken out. So they were, you know, contacting us being like, could you find out what the hell's going on with Comcast? So I spent yesterday working on getting Comcast to answer questions and get it all together. And everybody's Comcast was restored as of this morning. We have a piece up at the site right now at eastlansinginfo.news, which is about that. It's an editorial by me asked, should a local news organization be bugging Comcast? And the answer is yes, because it's what people needed here of us at that moment. And so that's what we did. So we're a new kind of model, although I've now met a number of organizations that are modeled on what I did, and they are the same thing. They are a group of citizens who've gotten together and decided that they have to bring themselves the news because nobody else is going to do it. And so they're raising little bits of money on a nonprofit model typically, and they just bring as much news as they possibly can and go on as long as they possibly can. So I liken it to old-fashioned fire brigades, that it's like where everybody gets buckets and helps each other out.
I saw that I guess it's not really a competitor because you're not a profit organization, but the Lansing State Journal appears to be owned by Gannett, which owns the Indianapolis Star and also the Reno Gazette Journal. I'm originally from Reno. And these newspapers are just shades of their former selves. Indianapolis area has over 1 million people in it, and there's no coverage of the city council, as you said. The Reno Gazette paper is even worse. My mom subscribes to it, and I think there's probably 12 to 20 pages of actual newspaper delivered every day. And it used to easily be 3 or 4 times that size. What comes as the Sunday paper now does not even resemble in volume what the daily paper was when I was growing up. And I realized that some of that is because advertising has shifted. But just the amount of information that is distributed daily is just fractional.
I think the other danger is not just that people don't know what's going on in their towns, which means that governments are running unchecked and deals are being made that we never even know about. And when the power goes out, you have no idea who to call other than your power company. The other problem with that is that when news used to be very vibrant locally, people had a sense of what news should look like, right? They had a sense of what factual news looked like because they knew, they had a sense of what was real and not real. And if something was being reported that was really not real, people objected and truth was brought to bear in many cases. So local news, it was in some ways where you learned what news is. And I think part of the reason we have the problem we do today, where we have so much misinformation and disinformation and organizations that promulgate fake stuff, is because of the loss of local news. I think in some ways, local news was sort of an inoculation that helped us understand the way news should work. So what we've found in East Lansing has been really interesting to me because we've engaged the whole town in news. You know, we use local people as reporters and as photographers and as editors. We rely on local money. So people here are very engaged in the process. They are, Eli belongs to them. Eli is what we call East Lansing Info. Eli belongs to them. And I always remind them of that. It doesn't belong to me. It belongs to you. It belongs to all of us. They, you know, are very engaged. They tell us what they want us reporting. They criticize what we report in some cases. They bring information. They, you know, light up our phones with tips. They send us tips. They drop them off on my porch or they send it to our post office box or they hand it to my reporters who they see at the grocery store. And because they're very, very engaged, they feel a sort of level of democracy that is so intense. They want their government to be accountable. They want to know what's happening financially. They want to know who they're voting for. The level of vibrancy of democracy here is really different because they're engaged in the news production process. And that is something that makes me think people should do this all over the place, because if you can engage a city the way we've engaged this city, I really feel like the benefits is not just news. The benefit is the attitudinal change. It's epistemology in the wild. And, you know, I was telling somebody the other day, I got to write a book about all of this because it's been so interesting, but it's in many ways the natural sequence to Galileo's Middle Finger, because Galileo's Middle Finger is about trying to bring epistemology to bear in the academic setting, trying to get people to understand what, how do we know what we know? How do we figure out what is true? How do we face truth even when it's hard for us to hear what's being said? And that's basically what I've ended up doing sort of by accident at the local level, is engaging in this question of epistemology in the wild. How do we figure out what's real about the pension system? You know, like a group of us tried to tackle the pension system this week. And the truth is, like, the condition our pension system is in totally depends on which numbers you're pulling. And the numbers are all based on assumptions, and the assumptions may be completely wrong, right? So we went down that rabbit hole, and it was a really important exercise for us to do about the uncertainty level of our financial situation in East Lansing. It was really good. So I found that all super, super interesting and very, very satisfying in a lot of ways. Although the city manager hates me.
Well, that's good.
Yeah. I just came from the Board of Review right before I got on with you guys. And it was like, I've never been to the Board of Review before. I didn't know what they did. It was a meeting I never paid any attention to, but it was on the schedule today and I had some free time. So I decided to go over and I'm looking at their agenda. I'm like, their agenda is done all wrong under the Open Meetings Act and their minutes are done all wrong. It doesn't tell me anything. So I just got up and I was like, you know, I really think on the minutes and the agenda, you should tell us what you're doing. Like, it would be really helpful other than this is what we do. You could actually tell us the items that you're going to be voting on and do it. And they got the chair got really mad at me. He was like, who are you? And why are you asking? Why do you think we're covering things up? I was like, no, I don't think you're covering anything up. I just want to know what's going on, right? And then my council member who's sitting next to me, who happens to be a lawyer who sued the city for me a few months ago, but now he's been elected to council, is like, we'll deal with this later, but she has a point. You should actually tell people what the hell you're doing. But it's been interesting. Well, it's definitely been interesting.
You're afflicting the comfortable, right?
I don't know that they think they're comfortable, but yes, I'm afflicting, definitely.
Afflicting the uncomfortable.
I'm at least an affliction. I'm sure many people feel I am an affliction, but the team does awesome work. I mean, now they bring, you know, reporting comes in that I've had no part of, and I'm reading it, and I'm like, wow, this is totally interesting. Totally, totally fascinating. So the fun part of the story, by the way, is the developer who at the beginning got me involved in going to city council, he just sued me for defamation. So perfect narrative arc.
And so he lost, right?
He lost. He's going to appeal. I think he'll lose the appeal. I can't imagine he's not going to lose the appeal. And we're going to ask for sanctions, which means we're going to ask for the money back that we had to pay the lawyers. But yeah, he lost. That was very fun.
Good.
I enjoyed that court hearing. I was very stressed out during that court hearing, but I, in retrospect, enjoyed it. The judge who got to rule on this has the awesome name of Dragonchuck. That's her surname, Joyce Dragonchuck.
You know, for somebody that doesn't like arguments, it sounds like you've been engaged in a lot of controversy.
That's why I have to read the Tao all the time.
Court cases.
Yeah, well, the court case was very stressful.
Sure, but, of course it was.
You know, anybody can sue you. It doesn't, even if there's no basis to the suit. Right. And because of COVID, the courts drag on and on and on and on. The dismissal took a very long time. It was dismissed. It never made it to court, really. I mean, it made it to the judge, and the judge said, there's no case here. But it was 6 or 7 months and a lot of money.
Yeah, no, that's horrible.
I get stripes on my arm for it, though. I get badges and merit badges and things now. Journalists think I'm real because I've been sued.
Nina, did you have any other questions?
Let's see. Okay, well then, on our list of questions, and on my mind, actually, autogynephilia. You tweeted once, it was a short tweet, and Twitter is not a good forum for nuance. And I believe your short tweet was said something like, there's nothing wrong with autogynephilia. And
which I say 1,000 times a week, yes. Yes.
And it's like that tweet, like, I agree with it. There's nothing inherently wrong with autogynephilia. Nothing inherently wrong with it. And yet it is associated with and overlaps with a lot of things that are, shall we say, problematic. And so when I saw that on Twitter, I was like, oh, like, I think I know what she means. But
we would say the same thing about male heterosexuality, right? That there's nothing inherently wrong with male heterosexuality, but it overlaps with a lot of problematic behavior.
We could, in fact, say that. We could. Yeah. Anyway, I thought, like, well, let's talk about autogynephilia. I don't know if you're familiar with things going on in the gender critical world. The gender critical world is starting to eat itself. I think it's gotten big enough and it's now getting strong enough that it can enact its own autoimmune disorder, like what we see in many.
That's a good analogy for it. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. No, it's like it's attacking itself.
I would say it's shitting on itself since that's what my autoimmune disorder causes me to do. But yes, yes.
My own experience with autogynephilia, which we really need to have an autogynephilia episode, which is why we should talk to Michael Bailey, or maybe we could talk to some autogynephiles. My own thought about autogynephilia. So like I say, like, I do agree with you. I've had some autogynephilic lovers, and autogynephilia by itself, there is nothing wrong with it. But right now it is in the context of a movement. It's sort of like kink. Like, kink by itself, there's nothing wrong with kink by itself either. But there are a lot of issues about trampling boundaries in its practice. So when I was in sex positive San Francisco, kink, the kink community there in the 90s was very adamant about consent, very adamant about appropriate places to play, so to speak. And what's happened with autogynephilia in the modern trans activist movement is people are being involved in it without their consent. That's not inherent to autogynephilia, but it's become almost a platform of some trans activists to eliminate these boundaries. And so autogynephilia becomes very much associated with this kind of boundary crossing. Is that making sense? Like,
yeah. Although, again, to my mind, I mean, maybe it's because I'm a lumper and not a splitter. I don't think this is special to this orientation. I think there are a lot of orientations where people struggle to understand appropriate boundaries. Again, I mean, you know, like, I certainly had the experience as a woman who was a feminist within the academy, going to feminist mini conferences, for example, of just having people who were gynophilically oriented, that is to say women who are into women, just really overstepping boundaries in ways that just I had to tell them stop. You know, I'm here as a woman at a feminist conference talking about women's sexuality. That doesn't mean I want to have sex with you. Like, and don't accuse me of being like inadequately politically conscious because I'm not into trying sex with a woman. It just doesn't do anything for me. These were natal women, right? Women born females who would cross the line. And I found it not okay. And I would say a lot more, I experienced that with plain vanilla, or apparently plain vanilla straight men, right? Who cross boundaries in ways that are totally inappropriate from my point of view, and who I have to say, you know, step back, get on the other side of the line. So I don't think there's anything special about autogynephilia in this way, except that maybe one of the things that's happened is this sort of halo thing around being trans, where you're not supposed to challenge anybody who's trans about anything.
Correct.
And that's where that becomes a problem.
Correct. I like that.
You like the halo?
Yeah. I like being right all the time.
Well, you are. So what are we going to do about that?
Thank you.
He's also wrong all the time, as we've learned in other circles.
Well,
in some circles, he's right all the time. And in others, or I should say in some circles, she's right all the time. And in other circles, he's wrong all the time. But anyway, with the typical boundary crossing, or the more common boundary crossing of straight men, we are supposed to challenge this. We are at least on the left. There was the Me Too movement, and so-called straight men are frequently vilified. But if those heterosexual men identify as trans, then it becomes much more difficult for women to challenge them.
I'm just a lumper, so my feeling is, you know, call out shit behavior where shit behavior happens, and it's not about the identity.
Yes, but frequently, like the lesbians that call out the shit behavior are immediately labeled as transphobic. The women that call out the shit behavior are immediately labeled as transphobic.
And that's not okay, obviously.
You are so shamed. And so women are terrified to do it, right? Because they don't want to be called transphobic. So it's this real, and then there's policies in place, right? Policies where, heterosexual men that don't identify as trans are not permitted to go into women's locker rooms or share a ward with female patients. They're certainly not allowed to compete in women's sports, or, you know, box, you know, do boxing with women. But if these heterosexual men identify as women, then they are permitted to do this. And people that object to this are then thrust into a controversy and called transphobic. So, and when we talk about autogynephilia specifically, we are talking about mostly heterosexual men I realize that, like, you know, whatever, they're self, you know, heterosexual plus.
I don't know who all these incredibly offensive people are, to be perfectly honest. I feel like they must exist. I've not encountered them personally. I'm not doubting that some people have encountered these folks, but I have known a lot of autogynephilic people in my life, partly because I was so immersed in intersex life and, you know, there were overlaps between different populations and stuff. And I've had students who are autogynephilic. I've had friends who are autogynephilic. I've had relatives who are autogynephilic. I've had perfectly fine experiences with all of them. And I've not experienced oppression, sexual harassment, or anything like that from these folks. So I just want to challenge the general tone that's out there of, like, you know, autogynephilia equals asshole. That has not been my experience. My experience has been that these folks, a lot of times, have an existence which is, you know, kind of more bigendered than my life is. And for the ones who are kind of comfortable with the way that they are, that bigendering is something that I actually find kind of fun in a companion. So I don't know if you both have ever read the book Alice in Genderland, which is by Richard Alice Novick. Oh, it's a fantastic book. It's about a person who's it's an autobiography. Novick is a psychiatrist and lives part of the time as a man and part of the time as a woman. Doesn't use the term autogynephilia, but is clearly describing autogynephilia. And Novick and I have met and talked, and that I love that book. I really think that's an example of a bigendered life that is something that makes perfect sense to me. It's not something that historically we see as very common historically, but that in this day and age makes a lot of sense to me as a way to potentially live. It's something that I wish more people who feel autogynephilic understood as an option, because it's never put out there as an option, really. You know, the attitude is, oh, well, if you're living generally as a man, but you spend part of the time as a woman, that you're just fetishizing and cross-dressing. No, I mean, it's a legitimate second gender within the person, you know, and or it's a blended gender. And some of the time we're spending some of the time as a man and some of the time as a woman. And I think that's a wonderful way to be. And
can I just backtrack a little bit?
Sure.
You said like, well, your response to what I said was, well, I don't personally experience this oppression or whatever. And I'm like, well, I'm not a lesbian, but I believe the stories that lesbians are saying, and I
absolutely
believe, and it's like, I believe that these men are in women's sports. It's like, I'm not in women's sports, but you know, that doesn't matter because
my feeling is we should respect people's gender self-identity. So I,
really, even in sports,
yes. Even if a person is identifying as a woman playing a sport, I'm going to respect her identity as a woman.
Really? So that, mm-hmm. Where's the guy?
I, you know, as for boxing, I just don't think we should consider people punching each other to be a sport.
Wait, but that swimmer, I don't remember the university. Is it Penn State? The swimmer that just broke women's swimming records, the male swimmer who identifies as female?
Sports.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's sports. Do I need to prioritize competition over respect of another person? I don't feel like I need to personally.
So I don't have kids for some reason, but I have two goddaughters, and I know that one of them is getting really into track, and I know that she has, you know, this is all girls at this age are trying to build their own esteem and have some trepidation about asserting themselves and putting themselves out there. And I'm pretty sure that if she felt like there was no fair playing field for her to pursue her dreams of becoming good at track and field, and that it was just something that young male-bodied people that she was competing against, that she'd say, I'm not good enough. I'm never going to be good enough at this. So I'm just going to go do something else that I can be good at, because I'm not good enough to compete with these other athletes.
So I don't have a problem with creating classes that are weight classes or classes that are hormones of origin classes, but that doesn't make sense to me to call them gender classes.
Well, they're not gender classes. They're sex classes. Sex classes. Sports are segregated by sex, not by gender.
So they're not really. They're not really segregated by sex.
They're supposed to be.
So nobody does, except at the Olympic level, nobody's doing chromosomal tests on people, right? They're not making your goddaughter strip naked and look at their genitals, correct?
As far as I know.
So it's gender.
How is that gender?
It's self-identity, right? And social identity.
I would say that it's not that. I would say that it's making an assumption based on observational data that has a very, very, very high correspondence to what the sex would be.
So I think of sex as chromosomal and hormonal and genital and maybe brain development.
Yeah.
None of that's being looked at.
No, I think it's that there are assumptions made, though, that based on the child's continual history and apparent evidence, what they can observe, that the likelihood that just from observation that they could determine that the things that you were just talking about is close to perfect. Not exactly perfect, but close to perfect.
So they're not going to pick up the girl with congenital adrenal hyperplasia or with complete androgen insensitivity syndrome or stuff like that.
Right.
And that's fine, right? What we're assuming is we know basically the hormonal history of that kid.
Yes.
That's the assumption.
That's the assumption.
So I have no problem with the idea of we have assumptive hormonal classes.
Sex.
Okay.
Let's.
Well, no, this is subtly different, right?
Okay. Right. Sex with the potential exception of like CAIS people, you know, with the potential exception of some.
No, there's lots of potential exceptions.
Very.
So I think what people don't understand is that even within a sex group, like call them females, right? There's a lot of hormonal variation. There's also a lot of hormonal variation within males. They don't tend to overlap. But that said, what we're really talking about is assumptive hormonal classes. I don't have a problem with that. Let's just call them assumptive, mostly estrogen class and mostly testosterone class. And let's just call it that. But I'd rather we not call it gender because I think it discounts the self-identity of a whole bunch of people who maybe don't fit that logic.
Right. We don't want to call it gender. We want to call it sex.
Well, hang on for a second, Nina. If we called it assumptive hormonal classes,
mm-hmm.
We would change the label of it. But it would still, in all of the instances that you're worried about, Nina, it would sort people into the places that you would assume they ought to go.
And it wouldn't deny the gender identity of the people who you're trying to keep out.
Right.
Right, because there's no one at the moment with a fetish for being what are we calling the class? Assumptive hormonal class. Mm-hmm.
Well, fetish is a pejorative term, so I generally try to avoid it.
There's nobody at the moment that has a need to identify as a assumptive hormonal class that they're not in using that language. So the idea you're talking about is to change the language, because if we change the language at the moment, then we would have useful categories. But what I'm saying is the moment somebody identified into the assumptive hormonal category, then we would have the same problem again.
So I worked with the Canadian Center for Ethics in Sport on a document called Sport in Transition, which was trying to struggle with the question of how to think respectfully about athletes who might fall into the intersex or transgender categories. And, you know, one of the things we puzzled over for a long time is how might we think about the history of race in sports and the way that blacks and whites were kept separated out of an assumption that blacks and whites should not be together because they were biologically significantly different in a way that culture needed to maintain separation. And that happened in the United States for a long time. And sport led, frankly, with integration. It was integrated earlier than a lot of cultural places in the U.S., particularly in the U.S. South. And it had a very positive effect, ultimately, to do integration of sports because it allowed people to recognize that where there might be some biological differences, that the way that people were being understood was a way that was highly discriminatory and hateful. And not helping us progress as a civilization. I look back at that and I look at sport and I really feel strongly that if we want to separate people into weight class and age groups, you know, we don't have 5-year-old soccer players play with 25-year-old soccer players. I'm fine with that kind of age classification. I don't have a problem with wrestlers being divided by weight. I just think if we're going to separate people into presumptive hormonal classes, that that's what we should do. But let's not call that gender, so that I can still maintain a respect for the woman who comes, who happens to have a male biological history, but self-identifies as a woman.
But we don't call it gender. We call it sex.
Well, it's wrong.
Well, so as I suspected, this is a huge can of worms. And and I'm keeping an eye on the clock because the last thing I want to do is make you late for your next gig, because your
city council would be very happy though if I were late for it. So,
well, secretly, I shouldn't tell you this, but they did pay me to set up. So there's all sorts of shit they're gonna do tonight. They just want you to late.
They are too. They're deciding on the next city attorney, which is a story in and of to itself. So, yeah, no, I mean, I'm really trying as I get older to think very carefully about how can I make more peace in the world and less strife, right? Even though I think uncovering truth is part of how we get to justice. And that's part of what I struggle with a lot of the time is the question of how do I do work that is aiming towards uncovering things people should know and work towards truth and at the same time try to be peaceable and peaceful yeah. and respectful. And one of the things that bothers me is how much energy people are spending policing gender and sex borders. I wish they wouldn't. The people who are caught on those borders are, in my experience, generally not assholes, and they are hurt in ways that are incredibly unfair and unnecessary. You know, including in terms of being misled into categories. I mean, it sounds like, Corinna, you are one of these folks who was misled into categories that you thought might help you and they didn't help you. I want really a world where, if possible, we can give people lots of options that they can feel safe in, where they don't feel like they have to go down roads that might be the exit from their pain, but turns out not to be the exit from their pain. I want to help alleviate the pain. And I don't feel like this sort of intense border patrol all the time and the fights and the arguments and the way, yes, that the gender critical side is now eating itself, that this is accomplishing something.
I want to reach back a little bit to something that you mentioned earlier about when you were giving birth, that you said that it was a form of good pain. And what I can say is about coming to terms with all of the choices that I made that have led me to where I am now. Dealing with the reality of who I am was actually also a good pain. Good. So having to make that breakthrough of accepting that the thing that I had wished for can't be attained, that was something that finally pulled the thorn out.
Oh, that's wonderful.
So I think for other people in my situation, my expectation is that they're also going to have to go through that form of pain, because giving up something that you've worked so hard for because you can never actually have it does hurt like crazy.
Absolutely.
But you have to give that up so that you can actually heal.
Very much so.
I'm thank you. I'm trying to angle for a shot on the Oprah show. Was that deep enough?
Is it still on the air? I think it's not on the air anymore.
It's not. I'm out of touch. Isn't Dr. Oz trying to get a Senate seat up where you live?
I don't know. No, I don't think it's us. Isn't it New Jersey or something?
Oh, it's New Jersey.
Know.
Okay.
I don't know.
Well, what are you working on right now that you'd like everybody to know about? You said everybody calls your newspaper.
Oh, ELI.
Yeah, Eli. So is Eli the big thing that you're working on, or what's next?
No, I don't know. It's a transitional moment in life. My parents are very old and my dad is certainly near the end, and my mother's getting quite old, and I'm fostering a very old rat who will not have more than a few months, I think, left. So I kind of am trying to just be in a moment where I have space to deal with all of that. Mm. But I do get to have a sabbatical, I think, starting February 1st from the newspaper. So I'm excited about that. I'm not exactly sure what that's going to look like because they're still going to need my help for some stuff. But I'm hoping to write a book about having accidentally become a local news publisher, and which is not really going to be a book about local news. It's going to be a book about epistemology in the wild. It'll be a sequel to Galileo's Middle Finger in terms of this thing and the question of how do we struggle with truth. So I'm excited about that. I don't know. I'm talking to Substack about maybe doing a Substack thing, which I think would be a lot of fun. So I don't really, you asked what do I want people to know about what I'm working on. I'm sort of in a sort of quiet moment right now where I'm just trying to think about where we are. You know, the pandemic remains stressful and exhausting for us all, because I have these autoimmune problems with my digestive system that implicates the whole rest of my body. I end up with inflammatory responses. I'm really scared of getting COVID. I'm fully vaccinated, but I also know that my immune system is a total drama queen. And so I'm nervous that if I get COVID, it's going to be a long time before I feel okay. And because I have to help my parents and my sister who takes care of my parents, I have to be careful with that. So I'm just trying to be mostly really careful, wearing N95 a lot. I'm not a germaphobe by any means. I'm just, you know, we're not done with this thing yet. And it's...
Did you have
I don't want to get anybody sick, and I don't want to get sick.
Did you have a strong reaction to the vaccines?
Very much so, yes. Yeah, and the shingles vaccine really made me sick. I mean, that makes a lot of people sick, but I've always had strong reactions to vaccines. The tetanus shot gives me a 2-day fever, and yeah. So, yeah, no, for some reason, my immune system just decides to scream at every insult, so I have to be super careful around insults to my immune system. So I don't think I would be hospitalized, because the data is really strong that people like me would not be hospitalized, but I also really like not being sick. And I don't want to kill my parents by transmitting COVID to them, since they're both medically fragile. So, you know, they'll have to die someday, as we do all, but when I don't really want to be the cause of it. So I'm trying to be careful. So just trying to really be in a peaceful moment as much as possible.
All right.
Trying to be helpful to people. I really enjoyed being with you both. Thank you for taking the time, and
thank you for joining us. It was a pleasure an honor to have you. For those of you listeners out there that have not read Galileo's Middle Finger, please go read Galileo's Middle Finger. It is excellent.
Yep. Mandatory reading for the heterodorks.
Yes.
Thank you again.
All right. So until next time, so long, TERFs and trannies.
Bye.